Welcome back to another glass of Charlie Fay. On today's episode, I will be chatting with Sherry Brown, a wife, a mother, a successful entrepreneur, and a survivor. We talk about cultural differences and how they've impacted her life as a woman who has lived in three very different countries. She shares her experiences living as an Indian woman who suffered from being sexualized as a child by a trusted family friend and the importance of normalizing the conversation. We'll be diving deep into a serious topic which affects one in three women worldwide. If you are one of the 33% of women who have experienced sexual assault, you are not alone. If at any point you need to pause or stop listening altogether, that is totally okay, and I hope you know that I stand with you. Tuesday, everybody. I'm here today with Sherry Brown from Sherry Brown Photography, and we are talking about some pretty deep topics today. So we're really just going to dive right in. So Sherry, tell me a little bit about you. Tell me about what you do. Tell me about your life a little bit and how you, I guess, what you do.
Okay. First of all, thanks for having me, Charlie. and spending the night in my studio last night.
Yes, I did sleep in her studio last night.
Yeah, that's what we do. I'm Sherry Brown Photography. Oh, Sherry Brown, sorry, from Sherry Brown Photography. I live in Quispam, so in New Brunswick, which is close to St. John. And I am from Barbados, which is, you know, a small island in the Caribbean. If you haven't visited, you definitely should.
100%.
100%, yeah. I basically grew up there most of my life until I was 14, actually. And then when I was 14, my mom took me and my sister to India. We lived there for 4 years, which was a huge chunk of who I am today.
I think we're going to talk about that a little bit today,
we can,
too. Right?
Yeah. And then I moved back to Barbados when I was 18. I made a decision at 18 to go back home. And I just, you know, I was looking for myself. I was looking for my way in life. And eventually I came across a school here that I wanted to just get away from. Like, wanted to get away from there. I wanted a change. And I'm always about change onto the next best thing, you know. So mm-hmm. I ended up moving to Canada to study travel and tourism. I really enjoyed it. But just so happens that things align differently. And I suddenly, you know, I got married and I got pregnant and I ended up being a permanent resident here. And my husband got a job in St. John. We were living in Moncton, actually, at the time, which I loved. But he got a job in St. John. So we had to move and I was pregnant, you know, and I'm like, what do I do there? And I started to think about my life and say, you know, I don't know if I want to do travel and tourism anymore. And a friend of mine said, oh, do you want to take a cake class? And I'm like, okay, let's do this. Like, I'm like 7 months pregnant doing cake decorating with a spatula in my hand. You know, imagine that, an apron that doesn't even fit me, right? So I'm going to do this cake class and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm in love with this so much, you know? I love being creative. I love artistic stuff. And eventually I started teaching myself how to decorate cakes from beginning to end. But I still didn't like bake. I was the girl who would burn a cake in your house. Like,
I burned everything. So
yeah, I literally almost burned my house down once, I remember, as a kid. So I didn't know how that would go down. And I remember getting, like, you know, a lot of orders on Kijiji and stuff like that. But I would get a lot of criticism because my cake was burned, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to, like, really push myself to get better at what it was and do the things that I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I pushed myself to do that. And I became a cake decorator. I opened a cake bakery when my son was two, my first son was two. And I had that open for like 7 years and it was very successful. People just loved it. They died for it. It was a huge hit.
Sherry is an entrepreneur at heart. Like, I think this is what you were meant to do in your life because you had the bakery for so long, and then you kind of like switched gears and got into photography, and you became so successful so quickly in photography as well. So it was like, I feel like you were always meant to be an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. And I think I never liked working for anyone. I've had really bad experiences working for people, being treated really unfairly, disrespectfully, and I felt like that wasn't for me. And I needed my own thing. I needed to be my own boss. And I knew that if I did have employees one day, I wouldn't treat them the way I was treated. And so, I did have employees at Piece of Cake where I had the bakery, and I treated every one of them, I think, very good, and they're still like really close to me. I actually one of my bakers took over my bakery. Yeah, so she's actually she was working with me for a while, and she just like turned it into her own bakery. So I helped her dream come true a little bit too, right? So that was good. But I know, like, I started losing my passion. I started losing that passion for cakes, and I became a photographer in between that. And I know one day I was driving home and I said, I need to close the bakery. And I called my best friend and I said, I don't feel good about keeping these two things going, and I need to pick one. And I know which one I'm leaning towards. And it was photography. And it's scary because you're disappointing people. You feel like you're disappointing people. You feel like all that hard work and sweat is like for a waste. It's a waste of time. But I couldn't stay with something that it's like a relationship. You can't stay with something that doesn't fuel you, and that doesn't make you feel whole and complete. And so I left it, and I went full force into photography, and I knew no one in the photography business.
And if anybody is in the photography business, or if you know anything about the photography business, it can be super cutthroat
Very.
if you don't have any friends or any connections in the industry. Like, I remember feeling that when, and I've talked about this more than once, that I remember feeling that when I first moved to Moncton and I was starting to get into photography, and I'd reached out to a few photographers and just got either a rude response or no response at all, or they were like, no, like, this is my business. I'm doing what I want. Like, you need to figure out your own stuff. And like, the only person that I really connected with was Molly when, when I basically told her that we were going to be best friends, whether or not she liked it. And that's kind of like that mentorship started then. But yeah, it can be super cutthroat. So that was very brave of you to do that.
Yeah, it was really hard. But being in the wedding industry already, because I used to make wedding cakes, I knew a few photographers, from like passing by. And they were, some of them were a little bit like close and some weren't. And so I remember needing help with things. But like I felt like I couldn't reach out to people because one day someone did tell me that you need to prove yourself to have friends in the business, which rubbed me so wrong. And I was like, you know what? I don't live that way. I don't live that way. I don't need to fit into a particular type, a box. I can be who I am and still do what I do. And I don't need to prove myself to you
Or to
or
anybody,
anybody
really.
or anyone.
So do you ever feel like because you came from such a different culture that it almost you felt like you didn't fit in already? Because you were coming from such a different place, and like you grew up a different way, and maybe like moving to Canada, like did you ever feel like you fit in?
You know what? I've lived in three different places, right? So I grew up in Barbados,
And
which is
three completely different
completely.
places.
And as far as like, culture goes, they're all diverse, right? So they all have different ways of looking at people in different lights. So in Barbados, majority of people are black, and I was Indian. So I was a minority there. I was made fun of for being Indian. As hard as this, I had a lot of white friends too. So it was like a mix of people there, but you knew which people had privilege and which didn't. And I didn't have a lot of privilege growing up there. I was made fun of for being Indian, for being hairy, for being, certain,
All of these things,
stigma. And then when I moved to India for 4 years, because my mom and dad separated, I had to learn a whole new culture. pretty much. And it was, you know, I adapt really easily. I definitely feel like I'm a chameleon. Like anywhere I go, I will adapt to that. I went to India and I had to learn their ways and how to be like them.
That must have been such a huge culture shock. Huge. Because as much as you being Indian and, you know, like you being born into that, you weren't born in India. You were born in Barbados, which is a completely different culture. So moving to India would have been such a huge culture shock for anybody, really.
It was a huge culture shock. And people, you know, they looked at you like you're stupid pretty much because you didn't know the language and stuff. So I had to learn the whole new language. I had to read, write, go to school. And I remember the pass mark was like 33% and I got 33%.
Oh my God.
And I feel like the teacher really felt sorry for me. Yeah. Right. But like the whole system is so different. Like the corruption there is different. Like it's polluted. It's, you know, there's a lot of generous people there, but there's a lot of bad too. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of culture, traditions that need to change. So, you know, my parents were arranged marriage, which I don't have anything against arranged marriages. However, the criteria that you need to meet as a woman there is far worse than it is in one of these Western places. So, you know, being my color, I'm darker skin. I was always ridiculed for being darker. And so I would go and buy over-the-counter bleach products. And, like,
terrible.
Yeah, and these were, like, normal things that all girls used. And all the girls are okay. Like, the girls are okay to do that. But the boys, the girls have to be fair to be beautiful or have status, to be educated, to be taken seriously. But the boys don't need to. Like, they are
They don't
okay.
have any criteria.
They don't have anything. Okay. They, and pretty much you get married. And most of the time, you move in with the husband's family. Mm-hmm. So their parents. And a lot of stories I've heard, you know, and like being, you know, the mother-in-law expects a lot of you. And, you know, you're basically like most of the time a housewife. Or, you know, you need to bear
children. It's a lot older traditions.
Yeah, it's changing somewhat. I find that a lot of it's changing a little bit. However, that's still that stigma is there that a woman is not good enough if she's not a certain type. Mm-hmm. If she is not fair and tall and slim and beautiful. And,
so how did that, you know? Like by living in India and, you know, being like witnessing all of these things, like how did you feel being a woman in India?
Pressure.
And like, was there like different things that maybe happened to you in India that, you know, you felt like you couldn't really talk about because of... I guess because of the culture and because like it just wasn't something that you talked about in the culture.
Yeah. Of course you feel insecure. You know, you don't think that you fit in because, you know, you're not like the girl that could get a good husband.
Okay.
And so you start to believe these things in the sense that you start to live in that moment that sort of like it becomes normal for you. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh my gosh, I'm being like ridiculed or like you don't have any self-worth. Yeah, so you just live that life, you know. You start to you know, do all the things that aren't good for you. I was a rebellious kid. I was really rebellious. If my mom's listening to this, I'm sorry. I did sneak around and do that.
I was also a rebellious kid too, so I completely understand. I feel like we all are at some point.
Oh, I was really, really rebellious. And you know, being from a broken kind of, you know, family where my mom and dad separated, it was hard for me to understand what love was and like, you know, the whole arranged marriage thing and the culture thing, I kind of like, you know, I didn't, you know, I didn't really appreciate the things that were happening in the culture.
Okay.
And so I kind of like boycotted it and I just,
Okay.
So I told myself, I was like, I'm not marrying an Indian guy, you know? And I know a lot of my friends that did the same thing. Like they were rebellious in that sense too. I feel like things are changing now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more Indians marrying like outside of their, you know.
And it's more accepted now.
It's more accepted a little bit.
Still not completely, but
not completely. Yeah. And it depends on like your status, you know, it depends on how, you know, how well off you are too in some ways. And I feel like the more well off you are, the more you see, the more you learn Whereas there's a lot of people that live in, like, you know, their own little huts and little bubbles, and they don't see a lot of people. And so their culture is just, it just stays that way. So tradition, they marry somebody in the same culture, in the same caste.
Okay.
So in India, we have different castes. So I'm a Sindhi. So, you know, my mom and dad are both Sindhis.
Okay.
But there's like Punjabi, there's, you know, there's so many different kinds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I pretty much rebelled against that. And I said, no, I'm not marrying an Indian, you know? And so, yeah, that was difficult to live. And I remember I used to be really depressed, and I would walk to the church every day down the street, and I'm not even Hindu, and I went to a church and I would light a candle there, and I would be like, you know, I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. And that was my only thing, is like, I knew someday I would move, I would make a life for myself, and I would be content. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had to be patient, you know, and I just adapted to the life that I had at the time. And I developed a huge Indian accent. Okay. I did.
Yeah. And her Indian accent is like next level, let me tell you.
Yeah. And so I went back to Barbados at 18 with this Indian accent and this really bad dress sense, you know, because I was wearing like a lime green, like Leonardo DiCaprio shirt. And my friends looked at me like, girl, here's a garbage bag full of my clothes. Go change, right?
Yeah.
And I remember looking at my friends and being like, oh my gosh, you have a tattoo. Oh my gosh, you have, in my Indian accent, of course, tattoo, you have a tattoo. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, you have a belly ring? Oh no, that's bad.
Oh, right? Is it really?
Well, I grew up in that, like, for 4 years, I kept thinking, like, these are bad things. Mm-hmm. Like, these are, like, promiscuous things, right? And they're wrong. They're, like, sexy and, like, that's wrong. You know, you shouldn't talk about sexy things. You shouldn't show your belly and, you know, too much skin.
Yeah. Right? Okay. Just being modest all the time.
All the time modest. You don't talk a lot about sex and all of that stuff, right? So I remember, like, a few months in to being Barbados, again, adapted right away. Mm-hmm. I'm like back to normal Barbados, right? Yep. My Barbadian accent and everything. And I'm like, okay, let's go get a belly ring. I went and got a belly ring, went and got a tattoo.
How old were you when you moved back to Barbados?
18.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was 18. And I got a few jobs here and there, which I hated. Again, you know, I didn't want to work for anyone. And, you know, had a couple white boyfriends because I thought, again, there's like the whole like rebellious nature in me.
Yeah.
And yeah, I decided that I needed to change one day and moved to Canada. I was working at the airport there for a few years. So while I was working there, I was, you know, I was trying to like, I enjoyed it. I loved it. But, you know, I needed a change. And so I moved to Canada. And here I am. Sitting next to Charlie.
How have you found living in Canada different to Barbados and India?
Oh, yeah. So that's the third part of the culture change, right? So the third country, Canada. I remember coming here and thinking, why are these people so nice?
Yeah. Why do they apologize all the time?
Like, I remember saying, what do they want? Like, I had this, I always live with that. Like, people are nice to you because
They want something in return.
I always felt like that. And like, so I was like, why are these people so nice to me? Like, you know, they're giving so much to me. Like, and they were very accepting of me. And I started to become more and more okay with being who I was, more and more okay with my color, with my culture, because people thought it was cool, you know? But
I personally think it's so cool.
I never did. And I still kind of like have those kind of like insecurities. Right. But you know, the more and more you live around this culture, you still feel like you don't fit in because you're not the cookie cutter white girl, you know, you're different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. Which is not a bad thing.
No, definitely not.
But it can put you in places that you want to fit in and you want to feel like you're one of the crowd, one of the, you know, your fellow Canadian friends. So I am Canadian now. I'm a Canadian citizen. yay. So yeah, I worked hard to be here, and I feel like the opportunities that were given to me, like, wouldn't have been given to me in Barbados or wouldn't have been given to me in India. Like, I came to Canada with a clean slate and I made the best of it. And I feel like everybody accepted me for, you know, taking, like, staying here and, like, basically, like, taking part of your income, you know? Yeah. So that's a big thing too. Like, people are looking for a better life, you know, and people have to understand that too. It's like, not just because you're not trying to take over your country. We're here to have a better life because you guys have a good life.
And you're here to try to fit in, yes, with our community and with our culture as well.
Yeah. And it's made me really grateful. Like, grateful that, you know, I lived in India and I experienced the things I did. I'm grateful that I was able to come to Canada and live this life, because, mm-hmm, if I was born in India, I feel like it'd be totally different.
Yeah, definitely.
I might be married to some Indian man who, like,
you that you know, didn't want to be married to in the first place,
right? That I didn't want to be with, and, you know, maybe ending up living a miserable life. Because I have friends and cousins that, you know, have lived into the arranged marriages, and they've ended up leaving their husbands, mm-hmm, and over there, like, divorce is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just, nobody's gonna want you if you divorce.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like, the families are all like, if you ever watch Netflix show Indian Matchmaking, you know, they give you bio datas of, like, your potential matches. But these aren't the men aren't, like, you know, like match.com or whatever, like, the men aren't putting profiles up. The families are, because the families are taking you in, right? And they want to make sure you're from a good family. They want to make sure you're stable. So if you have a divorce, you're probably going to be, like, null and void. You're probably not going to fit in there, and you have to find a family that will accept that, which is very,
because family is very big in India too. Like, it's not just when you're marrying someone, it's not just marrying the man that you're marrying, you're marrying the family as well.
Yeah, exactly.
That can be a lot to handle, I feel like, especially if you don't really know that culture, like, you know what I mean, you don't really know what you're kind of getting into at that moment. Mm. So it's like, when you're marrying a man, you're also marrying into the family, I feel like it could be very overwhelming at once.
Yeah. So I feel I was blessed to live in, mm-hmm, like, to be born in a different country.
Yeah.
If I was born there, I feel like I would have made it normal, mm-hmm, and I would have adjusted to it easier, even if it was unhappy.
Yeah.
And a lot of people stay unhappy, but there are arranged marriages that work.
Yeah.
Because they have adjusted to that kind of lifestyle.
Well, I fear your parents, for example.
Yeah, well, my parents didn't get along. They were arranged marriage. They didn't get along. So that's why they separated. But 18 years later, my mom did end up going back to my dad.
Okay. So that is such a crazy story in itself. Yeah,
I know. Well, she went to India and lost, you know, she had to find herself, so.
Okay, we're good. It's going to keep going.
Okay. So, you know, she went to India. She had to find herself, and she was very, like, she was rock bottom. She, like, she tried to commit suicide a few times. I remember when I was a kid, I found her on the floor. Like, it was hard. It was hard in our culture, you know, like, for her especially. She's like, you know, she wanted to live a free life as a child, and she was forced into an arranged marriage. And she always resented her parents for that, you know? So I think growing up and, like, in India and stuff really, like, enlightened her. And then eventually she just decided that, you know what, I need that companionship in my life. And I hurt my husband and I hurt my kids. I need to go back. And so 18 years later, she picked up and went back. Wow. And now she's in Barbados with my sister and my dad and her new little grand.
That's so crazy.
Grandkid. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been a roller coaster, girl. Let me tell you. But I don't regret it. Like, I I would never give it up for anything, because it taught me so much. It made me who I am today.
Yeah.
Without that, I think I would be entitled. I think I would just take everything for granted. And I don't anymore. Like, I feel like a lot of people don't realize how much they have, especially living in this country. Mm-hmm. It's like, we want, but we don't really look at outside of our bubble and see the people that have nothing,
mm-hmm,
that are living a life of sadness and unhappiness, and they don't have the luxuries, you know, even a pair of shoes, you know, like those things make a big difference to them. But for us, it's like, we want. Mm-hmm. We want big things. We want lavish things, luxurious things to make ourselves feel whole.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I've slowly like tried not to, you know, it's hard to like, it's hard when you're living in this country, when you have all these things, it's hard to like separate yourself from that because, you know, the dishwasher, for example, I hate it. I hate the dishwasher because I used to wash hands, like dishes by hand. My mom would be like, wash dishes, you know, wash the dishes. And she taught us how to do that. And I hate technology and things like that, that make life more difficult. Like, yeah. I like this simple life. I would move into a smaller house.
Okay.
Right. But I feel like if I'm living here, I need to adapt, you know, mm-hmm. and I need more space for my kids. But then I look at my kids and I'm like, what am I teaching them? I want them to live a life of gratitude. I want them to go to school and play with their friends and not be like, I want to be like the cool kids. I want the iPad. I want this. I want that, you know?
So what are some different things in, I guess, the Indian culture that maybe wasn't talked about enough when you were a kid, or that wasn't, I guess that wasn't really normalized when you were a kid as well, that you really want to normalize for your kids?
Yeah. So the big one is, you know, talking about, you know, your sexual parts, talking about your private parts and stuff like that. I feel like growing up, not a lot of parents talk about that to their kids. Because, you know, with, I mean, you probably know there's a lot of pedophilia happening in the world right now. And like, a lot of, kids, like people preying on little kids and stuff. And I feel like there's a taboo there, you know, there's a sex was a taboo. And it wasn't talked about enough, you know? And I don't think it's just my culture, though. I feel like it's a lot of cultures. Like,
for sure.
I feel like my culture was just one of them. And maybe back in the day, nobody talked about it. So, like, for my kids and stuff, I talk a lot about, for me to be open enough. Like, it's hard for me to open up like that because I'm mostly modest and humble about these things. I don't like talking about body, like, my body. I feel like it's shaming. I feel shame, you know?
Really?
Yeah. And I admire people that do. And I love that about them. But for me, it's always been tough. It's been tough talking about my body. And for my kids, I want it to be normal for them. Mm-hmm. I want them to be able to tell me if somebody like touches them or inappropriately, like, you know,
says, feel like they can come to you.
Feel like they can come to me.
And they don't feel shame.
No, exactly. So that's a huge lesson, because growing up, you know, like I've gone through some of that, you know, and it's hard for me to talk about because I don't talk about it publicly. I always felt shame and guilt for this. And my mom probably won't like it, I'm telling you, you know, like, but this is, you know, something that's been living with me for 40 years or 30 years. And, you know, growing up as a kid, you understand what sex is from your friends. You understand what inappropriateness is from like TV, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. And I remember like having this uncle, right? And he would come over all the time, and he was a close family friend. Like, it was like he was our dad. And you know, it was like, and I know a lot of people can relate to this because I feel like 1 in 3 women go through this. And that's why I feel like
and
it's important.
And that's the statistic. That's the statistic. That's the realness of what it is.
Yes.
And so many women True. Feel shame about it.
Yes. So the reason why I'm talking about this now is not to play victim. I don't want to play victim here. It's not about me. It's about normalizing the conversation with our kids, no matter what age. No matter what age, because I feel like you can start at like, early, like 1, 2 years old, just start talking about these things, you know? And I don't think my mom really thought about it at the time. And I don't, you know, I don't hate her for it. But I wish that I knew the things that I knew back then to be able to talk, to be able to say something. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, it's mostly the uncles that do this. It's close family friends. It's your neighbors. It's maybe fathers that do it. Cousins, what are babysitters? It doesn't matter. It could be anybody.
It could be someone really close to you. It could be someone that isn't close to you.
Exactly. Exactly. And with all this sex trafficking going on lately, I was like, I have to say something, and not for me. I have to say it for other kids. And I have to say that it's okay mm-hmm. to normalize this mm-hmm. And that we are not victims, that we are survivors, right? And luckily, I was at the age of 11 when, I mean, he would pretty much groom us from the time we were babies to like that age. And so I was lucky enough to know what inappropriate touching was. So I was lucky. I think I'm lucky. But at the age of 11, I remember like he would come over one day and my mom would be out at work and he would come over and I was sitting on the bed and he basically just brushed his hand up my leg and up my dress. And I felt so icky, like disgusted, right? And I immediately got up and I like moved to the side of the bed and I put my legs under the bed and I sat with my sister and I just talked to her and I was so scared. I remember like shaking, like, this is scary, right? Mm-hmm. And he came up behind me and he sat behind me with his legs over me like that, and he put his hands up in my shirt and pretty much grabbed my boobs. And oh my god, like that moment I jumped like the hardest I've ever jumped.
For sure.
It was wow, I trusted this man.
Yeah.
This man was like my father. Like, what happened? What just happened here? Like, did he just do that?
All of that trust just vanished in 1 second.
Yes. 1 second. I was like, what is going on here? Like, you're in shock. Because the person you thought you knew was this evil monster mm-hmm. trying to hurt you. Mm-hmm. I just got up and I went to the bathroom. And I remember just locking the bathroom. And I turned the shower on to make it seem like I was showering. And I would just sit on the toilet seat, like crying and being like, just leave, just go, just leave, just go, you know?
I can't even imagine how that must have felt for you because of the fact that you trusted this man so much. Yeah. Like, you trusted him with your life. And then all of a sudden it went from trusting him with your life to, I can never trust this man again.
Exactly.
And feeling that fear being around him. Yeah. And like, you were talking about shame with this kind of stuff and like feeling shame with any kind of like sexual,
right.
Any kind of like sexuality when it comes to any kind, anything like that. So did you feel any kind of shame when this happened?
Oh, 100%. I felt shame. I felt dirty. I felt guilt. I felt like no one would believe me.
Oh my God.
I felt like they would believe him over me. And I also felt awkward. Awkward that because it was an awkward conversation to have mm-hmm. with anyone because it was never talked about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would hide myself in the bathroom every time he would come over and I would just sit there on the toilet seat and just wait for him to leave, tell him that I'm taking a shower, right? And he would come over every day and wait for like an hour and I would be the hot shower would turn cold because, you know, he was just staying and waiting for me to come out. So he could prey on me. And I was just like, no, this isn't happening. What do I do? And he left. And I looked out the window one day to see him leave, like make sure he was leaving. And he looked up at me from the driveway at me. And it was the most evil look ever. Like, it was hard. It was really like, I don't know. It just is hurtful that, you know, someone would want to hurt you mm-hmm. and being a kid,
especially someone so close,
someone
to
that
you.
Loves you.
Yeah.
Or supposedly.
Yeah.
So he calls me that day and the same day and goes, I just want to be your friend. This is what confused me. I'm like, who does that? You're 20 years older than me.
Yeah.
And you're calling me and saying you want to be my friend.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be like your daughter. My mom would never say that. My dad would never say mm-hmm. that. It's not, I want to be your friend. You're not here to be my friend. So something in me was like, now I get it. Now I get why he said that. It's because he thinks it's okay to love a child or to be with a child. He thinks it's normal. which is not, it's not normal. And it's sick. It's a sickness. It's a really bad sickness that they have, that he has. And like a lot of pedophiles have, you know, and I don't want to normalize their problem, but I want to normalize the conversation with kids so that it doesn't happen to them mm-hmm. more than.
Or that it, when it does happen, they don't feel ashamed and they don't feel the fear of telling someone about it.
Yeah. Especially their close ones, especially their family. Right. And I told my friends about it and they didn't believe me. That was hard to take. Yeah. It was really hard to take.
Because then you start questioning yourself.
Right.
You know, like, was it okay? Did this happen because I deserved it? Did this happen mm-hmm. because, you know what I mean? Like you're asking yourself all of these questions because as soon as you opened up about it, all of these people around you were like, it's not true. It didn't happen. You know, they didn't believe you.
They didn't tell me that to my face, but a few years later, they did tell me that they didn't believe me.
Wow.
Until it happened to his niece, who was one of my friends.
Really?
Yeah. Like he like inappropriately like hugged her and touched her and stuff.
Really?
And she was just like, I felt it then. And now I believe you. And I said, okay, see, like he can do it to anybody. Mm-hmm. They can do it to anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? You're not exempt.
And that's so scary. Like yeah. I'm so sorry that you went through this. Like I can only imagine the fear that you felt and like you've been carrying this around for so long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah. I can only imagine like how that must feel for you.
I feel liberated right now because I can talk about it.
Yeah.
And before I didn't feel liberated. I felt like I had to bottle it in. I felt like I wanted to expose him so many times.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that would make any sense. I didn't know if people would hate me and make me seem like attention craving or like the victim. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to seem like that person who, you know, that woman who is like lying and like, you know, all of this stuff. Yeah. And that's a battle that every child goes through, every woman goes through that goes through this because they have that fear. Will the people believe me? Will these people believe me? And will I come out as like attention seeker, you know? So that
and
was
I think
difficult.
That like in this day and age, this conversation is becoming more normalized.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's something that we can talk about more and it's something that
I hope so.
Yeah. I hope so as well.
Yeah.
But it's still happening. You know what
it's
I mean?
Right
whether
the
or
second.
Not we're, whether or not we're talking about it, it's still happening.
Next door. And, it's happening everywhere, girl. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. You look in your neighborhoods, look in your families. Look at people around you. You don't know who they are sometimes, you know, and they might be totally, totally fine, but they might not be. So just, you know, I pay attention. That's mm-hmm. all I ask is like to pay attention, talk to your kids mm-hmm. so that you're the first person that they come to, you know? And
I think that's really important is to make
important.
Sure that they know that you are the first person that they need to come to
exactly.
and that you are opening up that conversation for them and you are creating this safe space for them so that they can come to you and they feel comfortable coming to you.
Yeah. Because their innocence is taken away mm-hmm. and that's not fair. My innocence was taken
away. Did you feel like that when it happened to you, that your innocence was completely taken away in that moment?
Well, I felt like it's affected my sexuality in so many ways.
Okay.
But it's been hard for me. You know, with everything and with my culture and growing up and not being able to talk about it mm-hmm. as much and not being free with my sexuality. So it's been tough in that sense. But you know what? I'm not letting him win. I'm not
Absolutely
letting him
not.
Win. And again, I'm not the victim. I'm mm-hmm. a survivor of it. And like, I did look him up to see what he was up to. And he's married with a child and the little girl. He is a little girl. Who was my age? 11. And so
how does that make you feel?
Oh my God. It made me feel like I couldn't not say anything.
Yeah.
It made me feel like I couldn't not say anything to her about this. I wanted to like save that little girl.
Yeah.
I wanted to save her and her friends.
I'm sure that your heart sank when you realized.
Oh my God, I'm like 40 years old. I'm like, do I send her a message? Do I tell her? And so I spent a whole day writing this thing to her and his wife. And I said, this is hard for me, but mm-hmm. this is what happened to me as a child. And I don't talk about this to anyone. I don't tell anyone this, but I need to tell you because you have a child. You have a daughter. And I'm scared because I don't want that to happen to your daughter. Mm-hmm. And I want you to be aware of it.
I think that was really brave of you to do.
Oh, it was hard to do. So hard. And like, but I knew I'm talking about this not for me. I'm talking about this for other kids so that they can say something. Yeah. So they can have a voice.
Absolutely.
It's not fair. It's not fair what happens to young children. It's not fair. Boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And so she was shocked. And I remember I left it alone or whatever. And then a few months later, I looked her up and stuff to see if anything had happened. Like if she left him or what, you know, she totally blocked me from there. Oh my she God. Blocked me, you know, and it was like, and it, okay, this like is it, what it is. Like nobody believes me.
And that's what I was just going to bring it back to. It's like that you probably, you know, realized that she blocked you and then realized that she didn't believe you. Mm-hmm. And then that probably brought it right back to when you were 11 years old and that happened to you and no one believed you. Like it's like a full circle.
Yeah. And I think why it didn't hit me as hard when she did that is because I was used to that. And it was like, okay, well, I knew she would not believe me because he probably told her something and made him, you know, made her believe him. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised because this is it. This is how people react. I will say though, I did tell my mom and she did believe me. And I don't want to make it seem like my mom didn't believe me because she did.
How long did you carry that for before?
I told her at 16.
Okay.
So it took me a few years to tell her. But we were in India and he wasn't around then.
Okay.
So I felt like I could tell her there. Mm-hmm. And I remember like in Barbados when I was living there and he was around, she would get mad at me because I would leave the room every time he was there. And she would be like, you need to talk to him. Why are you being so rude? And I said, I'm not being rude. I played it off and I would have to force myself to talk to him. And every time I would look at him, these red like monster eyes would like pierce through me. And I would just be like, all like shivery and icky and like grossed out and like shameful.
Yeah, pure shame. Absolutely. I can't imagine that happening to you and then having to see him still every single day.
Oh my God. And he would act like nothing happened. That's the thing too. They're very calculated. They think there's nothing wrong with it. They groom you in a sense that, you know, they will put you on your lap, like they're Santa Claus and give you things like, be like, okay, you're my kid, blah, blah, blah. I love you. You know,
and I'm doing this out of love.
The problem is that a lot of them do it from young, like 5 years old, maybe. And they're groomed so well that those kids believe that this is normal.
Oh my God.
But it's lucky.
It's terrifying.
I was lucky.
Yeah.
I was 11 and I knew that it was wrong. And I was so lucky that I knew that. But a lot of people don't, you know, they don't understand it. And they grew up to feel insecure about themselves, shame and like,
absolutely.
Issues with being promiscuous and like prostitution and like, you know, not valuing their bodies, not valuing themselves as a person, no self-worth.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard. And some people commit suicide because they have to live with that.
Do you find that you struggled with your self-worth after this happened?
Yeah, but I have a way of like bottling up my feelings. And I think that's why I'm so tough sometimes on the exterior. I feel like I don't let myself go enough. I don't emote myself. Like my husband was the more mushy one and I'm more of the like, you know, I'm like always like, I feel like the mushiness kind of doesn't come out very easily, the emotions, because my parents, because, you know, they didn't really do that. And also like saying I love you a lot and stuff was not something that we did a lot, you know, to my dad, especially. My dad and I never said it. And like the whole sex thing and like talking about that stuff, I feel like I bottle up a lot of my emotions and it's hard for me to like express myself easily without being vulnerable. Like I feel vulnerability is really tough for me, but I'm learning it as I'm getting older, and especially 40 years old, where I love myself a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm learning to let go of that and be authentic. I'm going to cry right now.
Okay.
You know,
it's a lot. It's overwhelming. And I think that you're so brave for talking about this and being so open and opening up this conversation for other women who might be going through the same thing, who feel like other people are not going to believe them.
Yeah, it's been it's been a journey for sure.
Yeah.
But.
And at 40 years old, what if you could talk to your 11-year-old self who just went through this, what would you tell her?
I would tell her to love herself. I would tell her to respect herself. I would tell her that she's worthy, that she's beautiful the way she is, that she can do anything, and she is worthy of being loved by someone, by everyone. And she's enough, you know? Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. This is such a hard topic to talk about.
Well, whenever you dig deep into things like that, it like brings out feelings, right? And I don't do that a lot. So when I do that, it brings back like the bottle up feelings, you know?
That you've been bottling up for so long.
That you bottle up for so long and then you finally release it. Because you're always having to be like on point, polished on social media as a professional. Say the right things, do the right things, be yourself, but don't be too much yourself.
Yeah.
Do this, do that, don't do this, look like this, dress like this, wear your hair that way. You know, you're judged constantly.
And sometimes you don't want to be.
You don't want to be. You just want to curl up in a corner and be yourself. And, you know, you want to be free. Don't want to feel exhausted from all of that.
Yeah, for sure.
And all of these childhood things stick with you. Mm-hmm. They stick your whole life with you. And you carry that burden. You carry that burden with you. And you become something that you're not. And you can lose yourself. You can lose yourself
very easily. That's totally okay that you're crying. It's okay. You're allowed to, like, your feelings are valid and your feelings are, you know, like these are feelings that you've been dealing with your whole life. And I think that you're so brave for, again, I'm going to say it again. Like, I think you're so brave for coming out and talking about this, because for those of you who are listening to the podcast and, you know, if you're going through this, or maybe if you know someone that's going through this too, this might help.
Talk to your kids. That's my only message today, is to talk to your kids.
Yeah.
Is to start the conversation as soon as they're one, just little babies. Start the conversation about body parts. Start the conversation about what's appropriate, what's not.
Yes, absolutely.
About respecting themselves, their self-worth. Because if you don't, they might encounter something like this and they won't know what to do, and they may not come to you, and you can't stop it. And then one day when it's finally too late, you'll know about it and you'll feel guilt for it, for not saying anything, because they hurt your baby, and that innocence is ripped away from them, and it carries through their entire life.
Yeah.
It's not just when they're kids, it's their entire life. Mm-hmm. So I urge parents to talk to their kids now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like, this conversation is hard to have, obviously, you know, it's a very hard topic to talk about, but it obviously needs to be talked about. You know what I mean?
And
I want to thank you for sitting here and opening up to me like this, because I know that this is really hard for you to do. And I know that this is really hard for you to talk about, but I just want to thank you for, you know, coming on the podcast and opening yourself up to not only me, but everybody that listens to this podcast.
That's a first.
And and just, you know, being open about it and talking about it and having this conversation with me. I really do want to thank you for that.
Thank you so much for helping me be a voice to other women too.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? And I hope that everyone, took something away from that message.
For sure. Well, thank you so much again. Can you tell everybody where they can find you?
Oh, okay. Let's do some self-promoting. I'm Sherry Brown Photography. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook. I hope to connect with all of you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Send me a message if there's anything as well.
For sure. I'm going to put all of Sherry's information in the show notes for you guys as well, so that you can find her on every platform that she has a platform on. And so thank you guys so much for listening today. I know that this was a very hard episode and we really dug deep into some really hard topics. But I just want to thank you again for listening, if you still are listening, and have a great Tuesday. Thank you.